Hello, Food Chain. This is Sharon Chittone, and I'm a food tech junkie and innovation nerd who loves a good story. This podcast combines all of my favorite vices into a deep dive about the problems our food system faces and the visionary people working on solutions. Welcome to today's episode. Joining us is a special guest, Robert Jones, Vice President of Global Public Affairs at Mosa Meat and President of Cellular Agriculture Europe, amongst other things. Robert's work is instrumental in advancing sustainable food tech and shaping policy landscapes for the future. Today, we delve into the innovative world of complementary proteins and explore the intersection of farming, climate, and sustainability. Are you ready to unpack these vital topics? I am. So here we go. Hi, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while now. You guys are such pioneers of the industry, and we'll dive into all of that in just a second. But could you just quickly give us a little bit of insight on your journey and what led you to do what you're doing today?
Yeah, it's a bit circuitous. It's probably an unusual answer for many people in the industry, but I actually started my career in politics in the U.S. Most people know me in the U.S. as the guy who spent 15 years electing pro-choice Democratic women to office, and I helped elect dozens and dozens of women to the U.S. Senate and the House and state legislatures, major mayor's races, governor's mansions. I love the work, but over time, my career changed because I found that the more people I elected to office, the more they pulled me into their public policy challenges and all the little sticky wicket things that they faced once they were actually governing. So I began to focus more on helping people I believed in navigate sticky public policy issues. And you don't have to do that work very long before you hit the wall of climate change and air quality and serious environmental issues. And of course, the intersection with food comes quickly after that. So I found my way into food systems working for a global NGO called the Environmental Defense Fund. And I worked with producers of food around the world trying to get into better management and better stewardship practices. And for me, my passion, I really crystallized that my passion was at the intersection of food and climate change. Sure. And all roads lead back to livestock once you come to that realization. So I was looking at what's the final third of my career going to look like. And I made a conscious decision to make a pivot and seek out a job in the alternative protein space, the complementary protein space. And I got very lucky, and I met the CEO of Mosa Meat at exactly the right time, and the rest is history.
And the rest is history. And obviously, Mosa Meat is a true pioneer in the industry, no doubt about that. So, I mean, there have been so many changes in the past 10 years, but what are some of the roadblocks looming over us in the industry, and why do you think that is?
Yeah, well, I think starting at the macro scale first, we still have a serious challenge about a lack of a substantive conversation about food and agriculture in the context of climate and biodiversity loss. I mean, the media doesn't do a good job. Policymakers around the world are not doing a good job. And so that underpins a lack of motivation for change. And so we have a big task of continuing to move that needle forward. We had 26 meetings of COP on climate change before food was even discussed. Yeah. Last year was the first. It was not really a substantive conversation. I see it going in the right direction, but that's still a macro challenge. And then at that point, at the point that you've come to the realization that this is a problem and you have to reform the entire value chain to try to make it greener, better for people and the planet, you need to really support farmers to be part of a just transition and reforming the ways that they operate. And you need to really lift up new ways to make food, innovative ways to make food like we do. And we're a long ways away from seeing the real support that we need. There's exciting stuff happening in the industry in both plant-based and precision fermentation and cultivated meat. that's heavily supported by venture capital, which is great. It gets us off and running, but we're going to need a massive influx of capital in order to actually scale up these industries and have them realize their potential. And we're still a ways off in that, and that's creating bottlenecks.
You brought up a couple of key points that maybe the traditional livestock and dairy industry associations and big lobbies are creating these roadblocks. But as you said, we have to work closely with farmers. So what does that look like? How can we, and what should we say, right, to farmers to say, this is not about taking your job, but it's about giving you and diversifying your revenue streams and enabling you to do things better.
Yeah.
How can we shape that conversation so that we don't find ourselves with these bottlenecks?
Yeah. Well, to use a quote from former President Obama, I think first you have to start a conversation that creates the permission structure to get into the substance. And I think the conversation starter with farmers always needs to be based in empathy. Because at the end of the day, especially post-World War II, farmers and ranchers have done everything we ask of them. They scaled up rapidly to meet nutrition needs and feed a growing planet. And now we're telling them, wait, the way you're doing it is wrong. And as long as they feel like they are being pigeonholed as the enemy, then they're going to meet you with defensiveness. And the truth is that they've faced incredibly dire circumstances. You know, we've lost over 5 million family farms in Europe alone in the last 10 years. There's massive consolidation in the value chain. It's putting the squeeze on the producers. They're not getting the cost per kilo they should be getting for their product. And these farms are disappearing. And I think once you start with that recognition of the situation they're in, you're going to get a lot different conversation than if you just say, hey, I'm coming here as the disruptor and I'm going to do it all a new way. So we need to create a conversation that starts with that empathy. And then, as you pointed out, there's actually in complementary proteins and the vast majority of these technologies, we need partnerships with farmers, and we need to really do a better job of explaining that. In cultivated meat, all of the nutrition that we're going to feed ourselves in order to grow meat and dairy and seafood comes from plant-based products, comes from arable crops. So we're actually creating an entire new industry for farmers to create new revenue opportunity. But they're not going to hear that unless we approach them in a different way. And so I think that's a big part of what I preach every day, because I come from Texas. I'm married into a cattle ranching family. I'm a classically trained chef, and I've worked at both ends of the food chain. And so I probably come with a little different approach than the average tech disruptor.
Yes, you do. And that gives you, I think, also the right insight. So just, I want to pick this up and maybe we'll dive into it in a little bit. You, in addition to obviously your role at Most Meat, you founded an association, you're part of others. You just said you're a trained chef. Just give us a little background here.
Yeah, well, I made a conscious pivot into the complementary protein space. But that was after being at the Environmental Defense Fund for years, doing great work. And I loved working with the food producers around the world. But I also, when Donald Trump was elected in 2016, I watched them dismantle 7 years worth of work in 12 months. And it was super disheartening, to say the least. And I had very bad burnout. And I knew I wanted to pivot into the complementary protein space, but I knew if I just took another job, I was not going to deliver to my ability. So I took a 12-month sabbatical. I took a conscious break from life. And I went to culinary school for fun. I moved to Napa, California, and I went to the Culinary Institute of America. And they have a wonderful program. If you already have a degree in life experience, you can skip all of the liberal arts and just be in the kitchen for a year. And so I did it. I let go of my old life. I took in all of this new information and basically went to boot camp, food boot camp. And it was incredible. It was incredible. And immersed myself in food at the other end of the chain, the food service end of the chain. And I think it gave me valuable perspective.
Oh, absolutely. And then in terms of the associations that you founded, chair, which ones are they?
Yeah, so we were a driving force behind joining with other companies to found Cellular Agriculture Europe, which is a Brussels-based industry association. And we're lobbying and educating both in Brussels and the EU constellation, but in London and Switzerland, and the broader at a global level with things like Codex Alimentarius at the UN and at WHO. And we did that for a variety of reasons. One, because we knew even though Mosameat was a major player, we couldn't do it alone. One, it's very difficult to lobby in the EU as a corporate. But two, we really needed to create a shared voice in this industry in order to approach regulators and policymakers and educate them about what we were doing. And that meant getting ourselves organized first and getting on singing from the same hymn sheet, but then also approaching these stakeholders as an industry. And it's been incredibly powerful, I think, in helping change the conversation in Europe. And I can speak more to some details about that later. But we knew we couldn't stop there. We joined hands with the industry association in the US, which is called AMPS Innovation, and then the one in Asia called the APAC Society for Cell Ag. And we formed a global alliance of cellular agriculture to work on these truly global issues like Codex Alimentarius. The FAO has a roadmap to net zero report coming out that we've been trying to influence to make sure we're included. And then also we're co-hosting the Food Systems Pavilion at COP28 to try to elevate complementary protein into this global diplomatic conversation around climate change.
Cool. So a lot of stuff for us to dive into. So let's take a step back and go back to Mosameat. Obviously, Mark Post is a little bit of a father to the space. Can you tell us about what the company is doing? There's been tons of stuff in the news, a new production facility, your B Corp status. So how did you guys get there?
Yeah, well, I think that our DNA, the genesis is very important to our story, is that Mark Post, former heart doctor and former instructor at Harvard Medical School, and Peter Verstrata, a meat scientist working at major meat companies, were originally brought together by a Dutch government grant in 2004 to experiment with the idea of using human medical tissue engineering to potentially make meat. And because it was publicly funded and academic and open access, that really helped form the foundation of our company. And I think is part of the reason that Mosameat has really gone out of its way, even after they formed the company, to really share knowledge. We publish peer review articles. We put a lot out into the public space to try to bring the industry along with us. And some of the things that we're really proud of, like sharing with the world our recipe for how we move beyond using fetal bovine serum in order to make cultivated meat, because we knew that that was both a moral issue and a unit economics issue that would prevent us from scaling. So we've shared a lot along the way, and then we've grown a lot as a company. We closed our Series B in 2021, and we've raised a little over 100 million US. And that money has gone towards rapid expansion of our team and our production capacity. As you mentioned, in May, we opened the final building of what is the largest cultivated meat campus in the world. It's four buildings in Maastricht, Netherlands. And the new building is a new pilot production facility that when we have regulatory approval and we turn on the bioreactors, we have the capacity to make tens of thousands of hamburgers a year. And that's our product that we're focusing on first is ground beef or minced beef. And yeah, it's an exciting time for the industry. But Mosameat takes seriously the role of being a leader in this industry and leading with transparency and integrity to try to help the industry writ large. Because Mark and Peter, they wanted to make beef for climate reasons, and they knew that they would only make global impact if an entire industry built up around this technology, and that no one company could do it. So we really think in that way.
Which is amazing to be open about what you're doing. I think it's a winning formula, especially with the public. We need to scale rapidly. We need to drive the price down. We need to do a lot of things for this industry to really grow.
Yeah.
There was a recent report of how they see this industry consolidating. Like, we see consolidation in pretty much anything these days. How do you see this sort of market consolidation, like what people are talking about? Do you believe that will be the case or no?
Yeah, so there's a lot there. I mean, one thing I will say is that we also have to have the tricky balance of protecting shareholder value from those that we've that have given us the great benefit of investing in our company to help us grow. And we strike that balance. We try to be as open and transparent as possible to help the entire industry. And yes, I think there will be some consolidation. That's natural, right? Companies come and go based off of decisions. Companies get bought. But I think you have to look at that as a positive and as a cautionary tale, and you have to thread the needle carefully. One is that we don't get to scale and really make global impact in a $1.4 trillion meat market unless some of the big players in the meat industry get involved. And we're seeing that. There's small investments by Cargill and Tyson. But JBS has bought a Spanish company and they're building a 60 million euro research facility for cultivated meat in Brazil. I take those as positive signs that we are normalized enough now that major industry players see a revenue opportunity and they're beginning to get their foot in the door. And that's how we make global impact. Now, of course, we don't want to see that all consolidate down into the four existing or five existing huge meat companies either. But I don't think that will happen because there's so many players in this space that have a vision for making protein in new and different ways that are well beyond the commodity products that are offered by the major meat companies. I mean, we've got a member in Europe based in Paris that's making foie gras. It's a niche product, but it addresses a huge animal welfare problem. We've got companies that are making seafood and fish, which help address major biodiversity challenges in the ocean. And so I think you'll see a diverse offering of products and a healthy number of companies that throughout the coming years with some consolidation. And we just have to thread that carefully. But I think it's really important to point out that the big player that's not in this game yet is governments around the world. There's tepid investment, right? We're seeing things in the Netherlands and Singapore and Denmark and the US, but we need a massive infusion of public capital to really realize the potential of scale up. And that has the dual purpose of making sure that IP doesn't just get protected behind walls and doesn't get shared. So the more public research and investment and scale up dollars we get, the more this technology will be available for everyone and not locked behind corporate walls.
That's a great point. Let's talk about that for a second. Europe is behind compared to other places like in the US or Singapore, and still it's not enough. What are actions, both globally as well as on a European level? What can we do to incentivize, to promote cultivated meat and proteins to get them approved?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say the train has left Europe yet. I said there's still opportunity here, but you know, we need to continue to push the conversation forward with the European Commission and EFSA about optimizing the novel foods process, which is how we're approved, to make it as fast and efficient as possible without compromising food safety. Because at the end of the day, the European approval is still the gold standard around the world, and it's what will inspire consumer confidence to buy our products. And so it's really important that we still get that robust approval that people have trust in. But yes, other geographies are moving faster. On the regulatory side, I think one of the ways that is happening is that some geographies are taking a more scientific approach. And by that, I mean taking some of the politics out of the approval process. At the end of the day, you can do a standardized risk assessment of these products to evaluate whether or not they're safe. And then tell a company, here's the range of names that you can call it and the way that it needs to be labeled, go, and let them run to market And then at the end of the day, we'll fail or not based on consumer adoption and acceptance, which is that's on us. But when you layer in a whole extra risk management phase of politics, where you have member states who may vote against a cultivated meat dossier getting approved to quote unquote protect cultural heritage of food, or because they perceive, even though not real, that it will impact their home livestock industry, then you are creating roadblocks to get these innovative products to market that other geographies aren't. And the center of gravity will shift elsewhere. And that would be a real shame. So I see signs to be hopeful about in Europe, but we really do need to get moving. So that would be the first thing I would say. But the second is beyond regulatory, and it's more creating coherence between our national public policy goals and supporting these innovative ecosystems. As long as, let me put it this way. We're advocating heavily for things like cellular agriculture and plant-based proteins, precision fermentation, all these complementary proteins to be explicitly included in documents like the Farm to Fork Strategy and the European Green Deal and the upcoming biotech and biomanufacturing legislative framework next year. Because if we recognize these as solutions to our public policy challenges, like the Paris Climate Accord goals, which we are not on track to meet, and serious challenges with biodiversity, especially in what we're importing from places like Brazil, then it creates some sort of coherence with regulators who are trying to decide, is this a politically risky approval? And so these things have to happen together, and we need to make sure that these sorts of disruptive innovations are actually in these critical public policy conversations as well, and that this isn't just about a risk assessment and a traditional approval.
Absolutely. Do you feel also that countries like Singapore, it goes faster because there's actually a food security need, the need to produce their own food, right? Europeans have this sort of entitlement, like we have the best food, so we don't need anything else other than our agriculture, especially certain countries like Italy. And so you have that more protectionism.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, this is the funny, the irony, well, I guess not so funny, but the irony is that countries like Singapore and Israel have really strong complementary protein innovation ecosystems because they have quote unquote different geopolitical considerations. For them, it's food security, it's food sovereignty, which is in Singapore passed the 30 by 30 plan because they recognized that importing 95% of their food was a serious geopolitical vulnerability. And it created that coherence that I'm talking about. The 30 by 30 plan is basically every ministry in that country, even if you don't deal with food, was instructed to figure out how this fit into their remit and to make it, to accelerate it. But the irony is that sort of food security and food sovereignty pain point doesn't just exist there. It exists in Europe and the US and everywhere else. And it's shocking that we haven't learned this lesson yet. I mean, we've seen during supply chain shocks like COVID-19, Ukraine, Israel now, and coming back to climate, that we actually need to be thinking in the same way about how do we boost food security and food sovereignty. Let's use Italy as an example where you're sitting now. We know they're on the process of trying to ban cultivated meat before it's even approved, based on protecting the food culture of Italy. But Italy imports is a net importer of all of its animal protein except for chicken. But there's this notion that's based on bad information that a country like Italy or Romania or the Czech Republic are all food sovereign, and they're not.
Yeah.
The EU alone imports 5 billion euro worth of beef from Brazil every year. And that beef, much of it is tied to illegal deforestation. And the feed that we're importing that's being grown in Brazil oftentimes is also tied to deforestation. So even the animals we have in Europe, the feed is not feed sovereign either. So, but as long as we're operating in a world where we're working off misinformation and sometimes disinformation, purposeful disinformation around this subject, we're not going to make clear-eyed decisions. And I think that's where education around complementary proteins and the realities of the food system, even in an incredible place to live like Europe, we do have serious challenges.
Absolutely, because we are not talking about the smallholder farmer with his pastures and making milk or even beef, you know, the Kianina beef, which is top end. Like, we're not talking about them, right? We're talking about intensive animal farming that no one really is for anymore. But it's like people, the way they're portraying it is, oh no, we're like, we want to destroy the smallholder farmer that makes the beautiful butter on top of a mountain in Trentino, which is not.
This is another place that I see smallholder farmers being squeezed, because they're also being, without permission, they're being used as the idyllic representation of all meat production.
Yep.
By the very same actor that are screwing them on their prices in the process. A lot of these intensive meat production facilities will want you to believe that your average steak, your entrecote, is coming from a smallholder farmer, when that's not the case many times. So, but this is where I think, and again, we take a systems approach. We don't think cultivated meat or precision fermentation or plant-based products are a silver bullet to the challenges we face. They are not. But they can be one of the tools in the toolbox in reforming the food system, especially as we scale up in the coming decades. And I think this is where we need a real conversation about how the other tools for greening conventional agriculture also need support, like regenerative agriculture, like methane reducing feed, like methane capture in dairy farms. And how, if you can green conventional agriculture, it's better for everyone and better for producers. But that has to come in combination with some other form of intensive protein production, which we can offer long term. Yeah. And why, in reality, regenerative agriculture and cellular agriculture are the perfect soulmates. And it's not one or the other. It's going to need to be both in the long term.
Oh, I'm so happy you brought this up, because I feel the same way. And yet there is often almost like these two sides, very polarized sides, that, you know, it's like my solution is better than yours. And as you pointed out, in my opinion, very correctly, it's going to be about integrating and using every tool in our toolbox, depending on where you are, what climate you have, what are your resources, how much water, how much land, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. And another point I wanted to make is that in terms of actors in the conventional, I find that the vast majority of stakeholders in the conventional agricultural system, when you have a conversation with them, are very, very approachable and very open to the idea of how all these things fit together. Unfortunately, I think there's a vocal minority that is dominating a lot of this conversation and contributing to polarization around complementary proteins. And in all honesty, I don't think it's about us. I think we are a red herring being used in order to feed into larger opposition to overall sustainability changes. There was a group of people that were opposed to the farm to fork strategy and the European Green Deal before cultivated meat was even a real part of this conversation or CELAG Europe was formed. And their talking points haven't changed. They just added that now they're under attack from these tech disruptors as well, as they fight and lobby to oppose the sustainable food systems framework that's going to underpin farm to fork. And frankly, and unfortunately, they're being successful right now in delaying. But I think it's short-sighted for a variety of reasons, and I hope that any conventional actors listening to this or operating in this space will think about the pending storm that is coming in over the next 10 to 15 years. Meat consumption is skyrocketing in Asia right now, especially in dense countries like India and China, where a rising middle class are buying more and more meat. It's a luxury item. They want the same sort of Western diet that we've enjoyed and destroyed the planet with over the last 30 years. The challenge with that is that as that meat consumption rises rapidly, we don't have a way to meet that demand without it coming from somewhere, which means you're going to start to see shifting patterns away from these low export countries like Brazil. You're going to, and then there's going to be a fight over the what exists on the table, forcing people to lean more into intensive practices. So this problem only gets worse. If we don't take the long-term view and figure out how do we layer in more complementary protein to help meet that growing meat demand in Asia, then we're going to face a storm that's of our own making. And the reality is that cultivated meat is going to have zero impact on the average Italian or French farmer, right? The majority of our market is going to end up being in Asia. We present the opportunity to have more domestic production of protein to help make some of these countries net exporters of protein instead of net importers. But we're not having that conversation in a rational way because it's being obscured by a lot of politics and polarization.
Which is absurd. I mean, one of the best cultivated meat brands could be made in Italy, right? So made here with whatever marketing tools you want to put behind it. But as you said, we're lacking all the positives and just focusing on the negatives without even knowing the facts. I mean, I don't know how many people out there even look at climate and food production and as something that is creating a negative impact, and which to me is a whole big problem in itself. Also, one thing that often comes up is price.
Yeah. I mean,
sort of a vicious circle. We need to scale to lower our prices. But in reality, what kind of solutions do we create that are affordable for everyone? What do you think that's going to look like?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one, I'm encouraged to see in the plant-based world that you're seeing major retailers starting to address this, right? I mean, I think what we've seen like with Lidl in Germany and a few other places where they're consciously doing point of sale placement and lowering prices, creating a more of a level playing field. But that's the biggest challenge that we're going to face is conventional meat production is heavily subsidized right now. So what we're paying for meat in a grocery store or on the average menu is lower than it should be. And especially if you take into the account the externalities that it causes the planet. But obviously the solution is not going to be to raise food prices for people, right? I'm not proposing that. I'm just saying we don't have a level playing field right now as we enter the market, which means that thinking about future subsidies and the way we do true cost pricing, we need public support in order to subsidize our technologies as well, somewhere throughout the chain, whether it's production or at the point of sale, in order to enter with more of a level playing field. At first, our products will be more expensive than the average beef or chicken, et cetera. And that's just a matter of scale, as you pointed out. We believe confidently that we can get to price parity in just a few years, though. But what's really exciting is that I think long-term, we believe with good reason that we can actually position our products at lower than conventionally slaughtered prices, which I think creates an interesting dynamic, right? Because then it moves us towards being sort of the replacement for commodity products and allows farmers to focus on premium products and get better prices per pound, per kilo. But the reason I say long-term, I think that we can be cheaper is because our process is going to be more efficient. At the end of the day, especially a cow is not a very efficient animal in making meat. The food to feed conversion ratio is relatively low. A cow will make about a calorie of meat for every 13 calories you feed it. And that doesn't take into account the thousands of gallons of water that it's going to drink in 2 years and the impact of water. So our food to feed ratio is going to be a lot better long term. And so I think that we'll be able to offer better prices. But for the first 5 to 7 years, it's going to be more of a premium product and a certain segment is going to be able to afford it. It's also why I don't say to you that getting a cultivated meat approval is going to be a silver bullet for our challenges tomorrow. We need to think realistically about a 10, 20, and 30 year horizon for these sorts of innovative technologies.
Well, absolutely. But it's sort of that necessary progression. You mentioned a few things that I think are worth diving a little bit deeper into: true cost accounting, the negative positive externalities, which make up our food system, and how we can promote a better food system, maybe through incentives, by rewarding people who do right and taxing those who do wrong. So that's one part that I think it's crucial.
Yeah.
So what are the steps that we should be taking to promote these positive versus negative externalities?
Yeah, well, I think the first is a fundamental shift in diet, right? We are a big fan of the mantra of eat less and better meat. We're not trying to get red meat consumption up in the world. Where our founder, Mark Post, is a doctor, he'd be the first to tell you, you shouldn't eat more red meat. But if you're going to eat red meat, make sure it's better for the planet and animals. But I think we have to, the first thing is government encouraging a fundamental shift in diet, right? We need to be eating more plant-based products. We need to be eating less meat. And one, that helps address the externalities of meat production. But two, it means that we start to reduce the amount of pressure from commodity meat production and hopefully start pushing those profits further down to farmers, because I think they're getting the short end of the stick right now and not getting real value for their product. But a just transition for them looks like also providing them other revenue opportunities, maybe having less animals with more nature and getting some sort of carbon offset for that, and incentivizing them to do more regenerative practices, create more space for rewilding or mixed grazing, rewild grazing. Solar grazing is another really popular thing that I think we need to be looking more into and supporting farmers and setting up a mix animal agriculture, solar field operations. And then I think you mentioned this earlier, but another revenue opportunity that we think is possible in the future is even doing small scale meat cultivation at the farm level and diversifying actual meat production at the farm level. Maybe having less animals that have more nature, higher standards of care and health. You sample your own animals. You have a small scale, maybe 250 liter bioreactor operation on your facility, and you make some form of ground meat or mince meat from your own animals for own local production. You're probably familiar with the Respect Farm project. We're a technical supplier for that. It's a pilot project to test out this theory in the Netherlands. And I think there's a lot of promise there.
Which I think it's fantastic also to bring farmers together and to show them how this can be an inclusive process.
And I said it earlier, but I'll just reemphasize. And the other piece of this is that the nutrients that we need for precision fermentation and for cultivated meat all come from plant materials. So we need the crops that get turned into the hydrolysates that are fed to the cells. So there's an entire new revenue opportunity there to give farmers an opportunity to diversify.
Which is crucial. I think we've touched a lot of ground. I'm just being conscious of time here. I want to shift a little bit and ask you about the work you are doing with your association and what's happening at COP and what you guys are doing over there, and then get your last thoughts.
Yeah, well, first of all, again, I'm excited that this year at COP, there's a more robust commitment to having real conversation about the role of food and agriculture and climate at the diplomatic level, as well as at the civil service and civil society level. You know, I expect a few things to be coming out. We expect that the Dubai presidency is about to release what's called the Breakthrough Agenda Report, which is going to really highlight action items for food and agriculture in the context of 1.5 degrees Celsius and the Paris Climate Accord goals. And we've been feeding into that effort, trying to push for complementary proteins to be explicitly included. In terms of at COP itself, we're really proud to be co-hosting the Food Systems Pavilion. which the European Institute for Innovation and Technology, EIT
Foods,
is the secretariat of, but it's truly global. We have farmers from all over the world. We have the Food and Land Use Coalition, the Environmental Defense Fund, the Global Alliance for the Future of Food, a variety of others, and the Global Alliance for Cellular Agriculture, all as co-host. We don't agree on everything, which is okay, but we do agree that there has to be a systems approach. As a co-host, we're responsible for designing a full day of programming, and we got very lucky, and our day was assigned as December 9th, which then the Dubai presidency of COP defined as Land Use, Nature, and Oceans Day. And the next day is Food and Agriculture. So it's the food weekend that we're on. And we're designing, I think, really robust programming, but we didn't want it to be the Cultivated Meat Roadshow. It's not just about us. It's about a more systems approach of protein diversification and how the role that can play in resilience. So we've got a session on methane, which we see as the fastest way to get real results towards 1.5. And we've got, I can't announce them all yet, but we've got a major corporate in the dairy space that is making, they're announcing a methane pledge at COP. We've got a member, high-level member of the U.S. State Department likely to talk about methane. Of course, the complementary protein space and actors in our field. And then we've got sessions on oceans and biodiversity. We've got sessions on food security and the role of
food and diet and health.
And then our signature during the day, we hope to be a call to action and it be a ministerial level panel discussion between ministers in Netherlands, Singapore, Denmark, the US and Israel, all talking about the work they're doing to create innovation ecosystems and why other countries should follow to push towards a tipping point on protein diversification. And that's a pretty high level conversation between sitting ministers. So it's a lot of work, but it's all coming together. And I think it shows these other actors in the food system that we are coming to the conversation in good faith, that we want to be part of the conversation, that we don't see ourselves as a silver bullet, but that we deserve to be at the table.
Absolutely. Oh, that sounds like a great program. So for anybody that is going to be in Dubai and interested to learn more, what should they do?
Yeah, so I would recommend everyone go to foodsystemspavilion.org. And it's got our programming as well as all of our other co-host programming. It's in the blue zone, so you'll need a blue zone diplomatic badge. But we have, you know, basically 10 days of really exciting programming, and our day is on December 9th. I'd encourage folks to come by.
Fantastic. So I always ask this one question. If you had a magic wand, what is the one thing that you would change or create?
Well, that's a tough one. If I had a magic wand, I think the thing that I would do would be to host a tasting session for cultivated beef and require every member of the European Parliament and every member of the European Commission to come and have a delicious Mosa burger and see it, touch it, taste it, watch it be cooked by Michelin chefs and really normalize this. Because as long as it's an abstract concept, it's easy to throw darts at it and be afraid of it. But once you see it, taste it, touch it, smell it, it's a lot easier to get your mind around how this could be one of the things that we include in food systems reform, and I think would change the conversation quite a bit.
Maybe that's one thing we should get to work on.
The part about forcing them to come is the hard part. That's where I need the magic wand. I think as a final thought, I would extend an invitation to all of the farmer advocacy groups in Europe that are thinking about what their role is in food systems reform and where there might be an opportunity to diversify their operations and make money in the future, and reach out to us and have a conversation, because we're very approachable. We're not the enemy. We're here to have a real conversation about how we can work together. And I think if we could sit down and break bread together, that you would find that we have a lot more in common, especially these existential challenges, than we have differences.
That's wonderful. And if people want to get in touch with you, learn more about Mosa Meat, it's mosameat.com.
Yeah, I'm super reachable. Robert@mosameat.com or mosameat.com as a web address. Come visit us, learn more about what we're doing. and love to have a conversation.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Very welcome. Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Want a deep dive into food innovation? Subscribe to the Food Tech Junkies series. Tune in and listen to the industry's champions, whose mission is to reinvent our future by collaborating and disrupting the status quo as a way to rebalance our planet and our daily lives. For more great food and ag tech content, visit our website at www.edibleplanetventures.com. And don't forget to follow us on social media.